Hey, everybody, I'm Nick Layton.
And I'm Leah Bonema.
And we're the hosts of Were You Raised by Wolves?
Each week, we try to make the world a kinder, nicer place.
Well, that's the idea, at least.
I mean, we try.
Have you ever wondered what to do if you're ghosted?
Or what to do when a friend asks you to borrow money?
Or the proper way to eat Cheetos?
You know, the big questions.
So please find Were You Raised by Wolves wherever you listen.
You're listening to Heritage Radio Network.
You're listening to Heritage Radio Network. HRN is food and beverage radio supported by you. Learn more at heritageradionetwork.org.
So you don't shun the devil with your rock and roll, Lord. Knows that country music's gonna save your soul. The devil runs his groove in them rhythm and blues that Sam is gonna get you some.
Welcome back to The Speakeasy. I'm Damon Bolte.
I'm Souther Teague.
And I'm Greg Benson. And wow, is that what you guys look like?
Yeah.
Jesus. Damon, what happened to your beard?
I trimmed it down.
Yeah, trimmed down again.
Yeah.
Well, yeah, I mean.
Spring is growing.
We're on the radio, man. Don't run it for everyone.
Not anymore. Not anymore, baby. This is, if you're watching us through our Patreon feed, this is our live video episode.
That's right.
So you can finally see this fun little closet that I've been podcasting from for like 3 years, which is kind of insane to think about.
Yeah, and bitching about.
Yeah, so this is what the back of it looks like, guys. I know you. The people have been wondering, and we delivered. We are nothing if not servants of the people here on The Speakeasy.
Indeed. My voice sounds a little shot today because I've been up for over 24 hours. I just got off the red eye from L.A. I was out there doing L.A. spirits with a big panel of folks tasting just an absolute boatload of different spirits from all over the place, blind tasting. Tons of fun. Second time I've gotten to do it with LA Spirits. Yeah. It's a real experience and really professionally done. And the results are going to be great. I'm excited for them to post up the results.
Those are fun. Yeah. I've done quite a few of them, Las Vegas, New York. I think I did San Francisco once. But you do wake up at like 8 o'clock in the morning and start drinking vodka. You feel a little guilty about that. Or you're not drinking. You're tasting.
It's for work. Yeah, it's tasting and it's for work. It's a completely different part of your brain.
Yeah. Our call time each morning was exactly that, 8 a.m. And you start and you go until around 5 p.m. You know, with a little lunch break in there.
And what do you have for lunch?
You know, it's good work if you can get it. That's all I'm going to say.
Yeah. What did you have for lunch, though? I mean, at the end of the day and at lunchtime, we were so close to the local, like, I think it was Molly Whiskey or something like that. And everyone, at the end of the day, after you taste all that stuff, you're just like, man, I just want a fucking Miller High Life.
Just want, like, the beer, right?
Just the plainest thing in the world. But you can't sleep on red eyes even after all that.
No, I can't sleep on planes. I can't sleep on any moving vehicle with the exception of boats. Everybody knows how much I love boats. Okay. I can sleep on a boat. Yeah, there's just about motion, movement. I can't get it.
Maybe if you get enough sky miles, you can convince the pilot to kind of like, you know, gently rock the plane in the air. Yeah, exactly. Simulate those wave motions. I bet. What? How many miles do you think that would take? Like a couple hundred thousand? Like just once. Get a nice red eye and just see if it works.
Yeah, I'd have to fly a lot more, I think, Greg.
I used to do that trip a lot, and I always like whenever I'd come back east, I'd always take a red eye because I could sleep like a baby on that flight. I sleep really well on flights, actually. But, you know, it also might have something to do with the drinks I have in the airport, the drinks I have on the flight, and just, you know, every time I come out.
I do drink quite a bit on the flight since I can't sleep. As I was saying before we got on the air, you know, when you're the only person on the whole damn plane that's awake, you get service pretty quickly. So I had several scotch and soda on the way back. I do want to mention one thing, just a little bit of a shameless plug, housekeeping, whatever you want to call it. You know, the fourth season of my show on Gush, we've changed the name from Bitter's Truth to Souther Hospitality. Season 4 is coming up very soon. If you want to join me for a monthly Zoom interactive show where we're going to talk about all kinds of techniques and, you know, hone your bartending skills, Get over to gush.com, G-U-S-H, just like it sounds, and sign up for Southern Hospitality so we can ship you your kit that goes with the class, which begins, we do the first episode twice so that people can have a little bit of lag time to catch back up if they didn't get their box on time. But you need to get your orders in within the next 2 weeks to get on the first episode. Then there'll be one more week where we can get you into the second first episode. But go join the class. It's tons of fun. Again, we're going into our fourth season. It's been going pretty strong. So come join me.
Yeah, I got to sit on one a little while ago. It was a good time. It's definitely worth checking out.
Right, and not even sit in. You were there live with me in the studio.
That's
right?
Sure. I got to stand in on one and drink in on one, which is much better than just sitting in. Yeah, the drinking in is really where it's at. And speaking of shameless plugs, like I said a few minutes ago, our Patreon is back. If you are a dedicated listener of this show, when I said Patreon, you're like, didn't you do that a year ago? And yes, you're absolutely right. We had to mothball it for reasons that are frankly both complicated and boring, but it is back now. Sign up. I'll drop the link in the show notes. We're going to have lots of cool stuff. You're going to get to see what we look like. You're going to get to see all the times I show up to this podcast not wearing a shirt, which is going to be loads of fun for everybody. You're going to get sponsor-free listening, exclusive recipes from all of our guests, access to pre-sales and discounts on cool stuff that everybody else isn't going to get to have. So, and also just our unending love of gratitude that comes at every single tier you sign up with. So, going to put that out there. Link in the show notes. Would love to see you over there. I think we're done plugging our stuff. Let's get to someone else who has something cool to tell us about. Why don't we?
Hell yeah. Returning guest, right? Aaron Goldfarb is in the studio with us. You've dropped your latest book. I'm stunned to see in your bio that you sent us. I didn't realize you've written 12 books now.
I have.
Wow. Well, welcome back to
the studio. Not all of them good.
That's a very humble thing to say.
I feel like it's like parents who have 12 kids. At a certain point, they're like, "Yeah, numbers 5 and 7 just really kind of suck. They're just I don't know what happened there. The other, 90% success rate is fine."
Well, I'm a huge fan of Hacking Whiskey, which is the book where you kind of demystify all of the cool things you can do to whiskey, such as smoking it or infusing it, fat washing it, etc. But so this latest one is called Dusty Booze in Search of Vintage Spirits. So, I mean, let's just jump right in and start talking about this book. What was your impetus and maybe who were you writing this book for?
Yeah. So, a lot of my cocktail books in the past have, been the typical books with pretty pictures and recipes and, 10,000 total words. Those books are fine, of course. This is, my first, booze book, that doesn't have pictures, doesn't have recipes. You just have to read, 80,000 words straight. It's a narrative. It's hopefully a compelling narrative. It tells pretty much, the history of distillation in many ways, because if you're fascinated with vintage spirits, you're going to eventually become fascinated with how it used to be made and why many vintage enthusiasts think in all categories, it perhaps was better.
Hmm. Well, I mean, why do you think that the enthusiasts think it was better? If it was better, why did we change it?
Well, I mean, there's lots of reasons. I don't think there's anyone out there that can say for sure, depending on the category. Tequila is an easy category I always bring up. They're harvesting agave at an earlier age. Mm-hmm. They're not using, ancient or ancestral or even really handmade methods at a lot of distilleries these days. A lot of lame celebrities have inflicted themselves on these brands, and they're not going to sell the most adventurous flavor to their consumers. Conglomeration, of course. I think I write in the book there were no non-Mexican owners of tequila well into the 90s. When I think Brown-Forman was the first to take over, was it Herradura? I forget. But, it's a very recent thing where people have, cared this much about tequila across the globe. So Mexico had to get tequila to every part of the globe. And, it's perhaps not something that should be in every part of the globe if it's going to be the best tasting it can be. Bourbon, perhaps, Scotch, perhaps, can more easily scale. But that comes with its own problems. Again, celebrities become involved, conglomerates become involved. And the demand inherently, cheapens the product as more stuff has to be sent out earlier, made quicker, made more palatable to mass audiences. You know, you sound like a crazy Marxist ranting about all this, but, you know, it's true if you think about it.
You're shaking your fist at the sky.
Right.
Well, yeah, I can understand the tequila one is a very plain and pretty in your face example, but I feel like that example is driven by the demand of the thing. We do have other examples that where techniques changed over time. You know, the you know, Todd Leopold's bringing back the three compartment still, but you know, he's the first to bring that back.
Yeah.
You know, why do you think we left that kind of thing behind? You would think that we would only want to make things better, and if things changed, it was for the better. But what you're kind of arguing is that many folks think that some of the older stuff was the better thing, and we changed for
well, yeah. I mean, you know, Jamaica didn't even have a column still until like 1961, literally not one on the island. Mm-hmm. Column stills can obviously make more alcohol quicker, but a lot of people would say with less character. Yeah, I don't know. I don't know that the mass wants better tasting stuff. They just want more stuff and to get it to them. You know, I don't think a lot of consumers are like us. You know, If you serve a consumer today tequila that tastes like agave, a lot of them say, no, that's not the tequila I like. I like the tequila that tastes like vanilla frosting. You know, if you serve them a whiskey where you can taste the real character of the grain, like Leopold's stuff, like High Wire Jimmy Red, people say, You know, I like stuff that tastes like the barrel, caramel, and again, vanilla. People love vanilla in this country. You know, ditto rum. Rum, you know, in the 60s when column stills start really taking over, rum becomes a less, you know, characterful. I think I totally botched that word. It has less character after that. You know, whether the Cuban rums when Castro takes over and nationalizes the distilleries, Bacardi goes to Puerto Rico and starts using more kind of column still mass producing methods. And I'm not dogging on any of these places. I'm just, you know, the popularity and population growth just made it inherent. So yeah, but yeah, I think
I always think about it like Hershey's chocolate, you know, over The decades, it's gotten less and less actual cacao in there and more oil, right? They're just sticks of Oil at some point. But the American palate has gotten so used to that then you hand that consumer some Swiss chocolate and they're like, I don't like that, right? So Somehow we're teaching ourselves to enjoy the lesser quality thing. So maybe we're letting slip the better quality thing through.
Yeah. I mean, you give someone a Coca-Cola without cocaine in it these days and they're,
yeah, man.
They're going to be like, what the hell is this? I slept all through my flight. This is bullshit. So I kind of want to ask you a tough philosophical question based on this. And this is kind of, I'm hitting you with the Mr. President, why didn't you burn the tapes question right off the bat? But this makes me think of a conversation I had with Garrett Oliver from Brooklyn Brewing a long time ago that's really stuck with me, where he talks about how so many factors in the 1950s and 60s and into the rest of the 20th century, you know, consolidation of major markets, the rise of mass agriculture, transit infrastructure that made it easy and feasible for the first time to get produce from California to New York in time for it to still be fresh. He has this thing that he calls the matrix, where he's like, people realize, he's like, this is an era where you have a company called General Foods. Like, it's not like they're not making apples. They're not making ice cream. They're making food, and they want to make all the food. And this is him. Okay. I can get a little, you know, Lizzie boy Marxist myself over here, but this is his theory, is essentially saying, he's like, these companies got together and said, if we can make people forget what things tasted like, what good things were, we can sell them the bullshit version of it and make all of the money, not some of the money, all of the money. He's like, all we have to do is tell people, this is how ice cream tastes. This is how beer tastes. This is how apples taste. This is how tomatoes taste. And so many people have spent so much time unraveling. Like, I didn't know I liked tomatoes until I was like 25, because I only ever had the shitty beefsteak ones that are just water and pulp, right? Mm-hmm. But I wonder what you think about this, because we're kind of talking about this in the world of booze. And I wonder if you think that people actually do like the more flavorful version. Like, if you introduce the average person to a really delicious heirloom tomato or like a super flavorful Macintosh apple or a Belgian sour ale or a, you know, authentic old bottle of tequila made with ancestral methods, are they going to say, holy shit, that's better? Or are we sort of in our bubble saying, oh, wow, like if we only get people to try this stuff, they'll like it. And the average person tries it and they're like, eh, it's not for me. What do you think? Yeah. Is this a learned behavior or do we just, is there a lowest common denominator and we're just kind of shouting into the wind here?
Well, you know, I have an incubator in my house where I test this this theory. It's called Children.
So they're testing all of the rum and the tequila for you?
Yeah, you know, they pick Casamigos over Fortaleza every time. So but they got shitty palates. No, I think, like a lot of you, maybe all three of you, I was, you know, raised in an era where no stores I went to had a cheese section with, you know, French cheeses and whatnot. Mm-hmm. You know, there were no weird produce I'd never heard of. So I was raised on the bland tasting foods of the 80s and 90s in a, you know, third tier market. When you get to New York and thankfully the 21st century in a lot of cities, we've seen, you know, craft beer, craft spirits, craft coffee take over. Yeah, some people are drawn to it. Some people are still say I'm happy with my Folgers and you're never going to convince those people otherwise. But I think more people do choose the more flavorful things. The thing is they forget, you know, what these things are supposed to taste like. You know, when someone says to me, I like tequila, and then they like a very heavy additive tequila, and you give them a Fortaleza, that doesn't taste to tequila like them. Of course, they're not going to like it the first time. A Bud Light drinker doesn't like an IPA the first time, you know,
right?
But what are you going to tell them? Drink this IPA for the next 100 days till you like it and then come back to me. They got to gradually get into it and figure out what they like about it, or maybe they won't. I don't know. It's very tough to say. But the fact is tequila tastes like agave. It doesn't taste like vanilla and all, you know, glycerin and everything that's put into it these days.
Well, no further questions, Your Honor. Thank you very much. No, I mean, I think that's very true. And there's, I don't know, I think that silence was us all just kind of being like a little bit bummed out. And well, sort of,
I'm not bummed out by that notion. I feel like you said the word bubble, Greg, and that's it. You know, like we are all caught up in what we do, and it seems so big to us because we're in it, and our listeners probably in it too, right? But the truth of the matter is we're a very small portion of what's out there. So it's up to us to kind of keep these things alive and get them in front of people and share them with people. That's what we do as bartenders for sure. Trying to, you know, constantly, you know, gently educate people. I don't want to like cram it down their throats. They're here to have a good time, but you know, while they're here, they can also walk out with some knowledge, you know, that maybe they don't even realize they picked up because we drop it on them so softly. Right. And we also do it by virtue of, you know, at our bars, we carry the good things, right? We're not trying to shelf a bunch of stuff that would meet the criteria that we just talked about. But let's get back a little bit towards the book. I think we're getting, you know, we're going down our own little rabbit hole here. How long were you working on it? And how does one work on a book about dusty bottles when dusty bottles are not common?
Yeah, you know, I've been interested in vintage for a decade. I've written probably the most articles of any spirits reporter on vintage. Mm-hmm. The original kind of Americans that were into it were bourbon enthusiasts who would stock liquor stores across the country, check grandma's basement and see if there were any old bottles. And, you know, they were stunned to discover pretty commonplace names from today were so much more incredible in the past. I mean, I had a 1989 Wild Turkey 101 last night that knocked my socks off. Mm-hmm. You know, that would have probably been a, you know, mid shelf to lower shelf, I don't know, $5 or $6 bottle back then. Today, Wild Turkey 101's perfectly fine. Probably wouldn't drink it neat except at a dive bar. But this 101 from 1989 was superior. It would have been to be something today that Wild Turkey could bottle as a Russell's Reserve or something. So yeah, when you start tasting vintage spirits, when you start meeting the players, when you, who are amateurs, you're now seeing more professionalization of it. Canon in Seattle has been a great place to taste vintage spirits for over a decade, probably. New York doesn't have a lot of options. I'll give a shout out to my friend Josh at Down and Out. But
yeah, right around the corner from Emporia Margot. He's just opened about a year ago, and it's he's got a great selection of whiskey in general, and he does have a pretty deep pocket of dusties. And he's, yeah, and he's excited about them and excited about sharing them and talking about them. So it's a great spot to go down and out.
Yeah. Josh was one of those guys for the last, I don't know, 10, 15, maybe even 20 years. He was a bar owner, not selling vintage spirits. He had a great, you know, kind of beer and music venue in Bushwick called The Well. But he was, if he found old bottles, he was collecting them and tasting them and learning about them. And this is kind of his final labor of love. So guys like that would share with me. And it was a very generous community, these vintage collectors. I never became one myself per se, but I've always followed it. I've always written about it. So when it comes time to write a book, I kind of had a lot of knowledge and I knew the key players to interview. But that was mainly only in bourbon. At a certain point, I started asking myself, are there these same guys? And they're mostly guys in tequila, rum. You know, I knew there was Chartreuse, Pouring Ribbons was a famous bar in New York that had a pretty good Chartreuse selection, but I'd never met a vintage tequila collector, never really met a vintage rum collector. But I presume they were out there because you need to know a lot of vintage rums to make a lot of tiki cocktails from the past or to know what they tasted like. Mm-hmm. So looking at all these categories, it really just started unlocking the entire history of the world, not to sound too pretentious to me, you know, what was going on in different countries, what was going on, you ask yourself why did Bacardi leave Cuba? Well, that's because Castro took over. I honestly didn't even know that till I started working on the book. So, I think it's a read that will really open your eyes to how the world has changed through alcohol.
Yeah. Can't wait to check it out.
Yeah. Could you use that? Yeah. I was supposed to make it to your event down and out. But I had to go to LA and things just got backed up and I couldn't make it. So I don't have a copy yet either, but can you use the Wild Turkey that you just talked about as an example of like, what was different about that versus today? I'm assuming you did a dive on understanding what maybe they were doing at the distillery that was different than versus now, et cetera. Or is there another particular sample that you got a hold of during the writing of this book that you'd like to talk about? Just to kind of give us an idea of like what could be different in the bottle.
Yeah, I mean, I think Wild Turkey is the absolute best bourbon to study. You can't study Old Overholt. It used to be made in Pennsylvania, is now made by Jim Beam in Kentucky. You can't study Old Granddad. It's been made by two different distilleries. Mm-hmm. You can't really study Heaven Hill. There was a fire in 1996 that knocked out the entire distillery. So even if the modern brands are great in your opinion, the previous brands only match them in label only. Wild Turkey has been in the same location with the same men running it since 1959, I think. So now we can purely look at process. A lot of people question how was the corn back then? Now we're making corn for yield. You know, we talked about booze as being made for scale. So is corn. So are other grains. I've been told the oak trees back in the 80s might have been 175 years old that were being used in barrels. Now they're maybe 80 or 90 years old. Older oak trees are going to have more rings. They're going to have more places for the liquid to go when the barrel contracts and expands, more flavor. I originally come from beer where yeast is king. You don't talk about yeast a lot in distilling.
Oh, I think
some people don't, but you know, I think it's becoming a bigger thing. Wild Turkey used to open ferment in cypress tanks. They swear no microflora would exist, you know, a kind of house microflora on the inside of these tanks, but it has to compared to stainless steel, which is cleaned to an inch of its life every single day. I think that's a huge one. Entry proof, which is a pretty geeky term, is another one. Legally in America, you have to put alcohol off the still into a barrel at no higher than 125 proof. And if you put it in 125 proof, that's the absolute most economical way to make bourbon. But back in the day, it might go in at 105, 110, you know, so that's water that is evaporating, not alcohol, and more flavor is being left. I think that's a huge one. The wackiest one I've heard is urethane. There used to be a cancer-causing ingredient in high supply in old bourbon, and some people speculate that might have added the flavor. So, you know, we'll check back on all these heavy vintage drinkers in a few years and see how they're doing. Right. Any number of these things. A lot of people say once a spirit's bottled, it doesn't change. But then you ask yourself, why do a lot of European brandy and eau de vie makers rest their spirits in glass. They must think it does something. I don't know. I think it's kind of all these things that are causing change.
Yeah, and it's pretty fascinating that there's a standing example of a place that you can, as you just said, sort of study and see the arc and the change. You know, and those are things that maybe I wasn't even thinking of. I was thinking more of process, like, again, switching from a three compartment to a two compartment still, or even going to column, or, you know, how long to rest in the rick house, how, you know, what proof to water down to, et cetera, like.
Yeah. I mean, I think that is a thing, not just technology. You know, you go to any distillery today, you know, they could be making whatever. There's guys behind computers and hairnets, you know, doing this. I'm guessing in the, you know, 70s and 80s, Jimmy Russell was walking around just going, okay, cut, cut, cut. You know, he knew in his mind. I'm sure that led to less consistency. I'm sure they didn't have a lab with MIT microbiologists making sure nothing had gone wrong in the fermentation, but also probably led to a lot of happy accidents and, you know, a sort of more personal spirit than today. Not to shit on Wild Turkey. I still love Wild Turkey today. It's probably my favorite bourbon distillery.
Oh, same. And I understand what you're saying. I hadn't even considered that aspect, right? There was a little bit more of a human connection to the process back then than there is now.
Yeah.
And maybe that sort of more scientific angle is going to create a more consistent product. But as you said, maybe there's some happy accidents that we don't get to see anymore.
Yeah. And a final one I'd mention is, you know, back then the brands didn't have 25 SKUs. Wild Turkey today has, you know, 101, 80, Master's Keep, Russell's Reserve, you know, so the barrels are spreading out. You know, I've heard back in the day, if they had a 19-year-old barrel of Wild Turkey, there's maybe two places to go, maybe a duty-free offering or throw it into the 101. So 101 today probably is pretty damn close to every barrel's about 8 years old, I think. Back then, there might have been a mix of 19-year-old barrels, 8-year-old barrels, 12-year-old barrels. You were kind of getting their elevated stuff at their lowest price point.
I'm Lou Bank.
And I'm Greg Benson.
And this is an ad for Ancestral Agave Syrup, the critically acclaimed award-winning syrup that helps gringo bartenders better make margaritas, Negronis,
Lou, hold and up, hold up, wait.
Old
are you just
fashions?
This is how you start your podcast.
What?
It's not an ad for Ancestral Agave Syrup.
Well, of course it is. I'm just cutting costs by not paying writers to make something new. I'm just using an old script.
You pay writers?
Is that some kind of jab?
No, I'm just saying
What are you saying?
Well, look, we've got this amazing syrup that's made in an ancestral manner, cooked down from the sap of the agave, harvested the way these families would to make pulque. It's a quality product. It deserves a quality presentation.
Yeah, okay, hang on. Ancestral agave syrup is made by real families following traditional methods. Unlike the industrial Blue Weber syrup you get everywhere else, Ancestral is cooked down from agua miel harvested from Salmiana in Hidalgo, Mexico. It is the grade A Vermont maple to the sticky diner syrup you've been using for your cocktails. Ingredients matter, both in how your cocktail tastes and how you treat the earth. Ancestral is better for both. Is that good?
Sure. Or maybe confusing instead of cheesy. Look, just visit ancestralagave.com to learn more and to order your world-class agave syrup today.
And we'll call that a wrap. Catch you next ad, Greg.
Hasta pronto?
Ancestral Agave Syrup, available online at ancestralagave.org and wherever Greg and Lou are able to coerce store owners into carrying it.
I have a question for you. So, you know, we've talked a lot about whiskey, but what I've really noticed and what I personally have been collecting as far as vintage bottles go, vermouth and Amaro. And old bottles of bitters as well. And like, you know, I collect antique or vintage bottles of like Underberg, and I've tasted them pretty pretty damn consistent. But the thing is, I also think that any kind of herbal spirit, anything herbal at all, I think like you were saying about how things change in the bottle, I really do think that herbal spirits and liqueurs, yeah. And especially vermouth, I mean, it's wine. So there's a lot of different variables there. For instance, like Adam Kolesar, Tiki Adam, you know, grew up in Ohio, and his grandmother was a huge, huge Campari soda fan. And she would buy, you know, a case of Campari at a time. And so when he went back years and years ago, and he found a fucking sealed case of Campari from like the 60s. And so, you know, we did a side by side comparison with the modern stuff. And, you know, again, modern, this was 15 years ago. And he gave me a bottle too, which is at Grand Army, along with a bunch of other like vintage spirits that I picked up. You know, I've got a really good friend who owns a 150-year-old liquor and wine store in Florence, Italy. And she'll just give me old weird bottles of stuff, right? And there's places like Chamber Street Wines in New York City that you can actually, they source vintage stuff and you can buy it there. So I've gotten a lot of stuff there. But, yeah. You know, I feel like there's a really big, with people like Robert Simonson and Matt Hranick, you know, that are, you know, always finding like vintage bottles of Beefeater and Campari and old Puntames, you know, like for old vintage Negronis. I think that market has become a little bit more accessible, at least in my mind, you know, from compared to vintage bourbons, right? I wonder if that's just because if it's the boom of American whiskey or the kind of niche market for Amaro or both. But I think it's a really cool kind of subsection of what you're talking about, and it's still very accessible. You can find these dusty bottles, especially in, you know, liquor stores that are, you know, in the middle of nowhere. Like, you know, do you kind of dabble much in those kind of like herbal cures?
Yeah, absolutely. First of all, shout out to Tiki Adam, who tasted me on a vertical of Red Hook Rye, one of the most expensive vintage tastings of my life. you are right. Aside from chartreuse, which is, you know, obviously not an Amaro, but an herbal liqueur and Campari, most of their herbal liqueurs are a little more affordable. And there's so many made. I actually had two last night. I'd never even heard of the brands. From what I understand, in a post-World War I Italy, all these mom and pop, you know, Amaro shops were popping up, and, you know, every town had their mom and pop with their house recipe, and a lot of them were quite good. Most of them were not acquired by the Campari group, so we've never heard of most of them. But right. that doesn't mean they're not good. And from what I also understand, Italians don't really care about vintage, so you go to Italy, you can still find a lot of good stuff. Last time I was there, I found a few bottles of 1960s Amaro Montenegro for very cheap. It was in the bargain bin, if that's not funny enough. They've been trying to get rid of it. It's a nice place to start. You are also right, Damon. Things do definitely happen in the bottle with Amaro, whether kind of the sugars start crystallizing. The alcohol, definitely the burn kind of disappears. Certain botanicals raise up, certain kind of disappear, more citrus notes. But they're fun to drink.
Yeah. When I was in Iceland about a year ago now, Iceland has a very, very interesting relationship with alcohol. They actually allowed tourists to drink in Iceland before Icelanders could. They repealed like nationwide prohibition sometime in the 1980s.
What?
Yeah. Oh yeah. Yeah. No, it's wild. I mean, we've got to have another Icelandic person on to tell the story better than I can, but there was actually a whole thing where they were trying to encourage tourism, and they were like, well, people don't want to come somewhere where they can't drink. So tourists can drink. But if you're Icelandic, you can't drink
that's
in
so
Iceland.
Fucked up, man.
Right.
Yeah. And then, there was this sort of like glorious revolution where one day some guy just walked into a liquor store and the liquor store owners were like, you can't do that. And he was like, I'm going to do it anyway. And they were like, well, okay, we're not going to stop you. And that was kind of the end of the law, basically. That's Wikipedia citation needed. I heard this from a very drunk Icelandic person, and I'm repeating it like it's a fact. Fact check me on this.
When I was there, I heard some of this as well. But what one of the aspects of it that was the most backwards to me was that they had a prohibition on beer.
but not hard alcohol.
Correct. Yes. You could buy Aquavit, all the Brenovan you want.
All the Brenovan you can carry, but no beer to go with.
Yeah. But anyway, I was able to get my hands on a bottle of Campari that I think got smuggled back by this person's grandfather in the 60s or 70s, I believe he said. I think that was what was on the – I've got a photo on the tax label somewhere in the thousands of pictures I took on that trip. But it was really interesting how that sort of grapefruit peel flavor dies off, and you get a lot of these like very interesting like woodsy green flavors. And the sugar came to the fore a little bit too, because you're right, the burn kind of dies off. I want to pivot a little bit and ask about the process of writing this book for you. Because like you said, this is different than a lot of the other ones that you've written. And I'm just sort of very curious what prompted you to undertake it? And was there anything in the process that you kind of came across? You're like, whoa, this was unexpected.
Yeah. As I said, I've been researching this and writing about it in articles for a very long time. In October of 2020, I wrote a New York Times story about this Los Angeles-based Dusty Hunter, Kevin Ackerman, who found the great director Cecil B. DeMille's liquor collection from the 1940s. Cool. That story went a little bit viral, and then I had publishers coming to me. The big secret about writers is we hate having to actually work. So I was like, ah, shit, now I might have to write a book. So I kept negotiating my way to surely they'll turn down this offer. It's too high. And they kept taking it. So eventually I had to write the book. But I then I sat on my laurels. I thought, I have everything in my head. I can just wait to the last minute to write this. And then I got to January 1st of 2023, and I went, oh crap, I have 90 days to write this. So,
oh my God.
Yes. So, again, I knew the subject. I knew who to talk to. I thought I knew the structure. And so it was just, you know, 1,000 pages a day, several interviews a day. But as I started writing, as I said, things started popping up. I thought it was only going to be a book about bourbon hunters, because I thought those was the only people who cared about vintage. Mm-hmm. And at a certain point, I realized this book is going to be really freaking boring because there's too much sameness. So I started delving into all the categories. I met great people in tequila. You know, 1 2-hour phone call with Mark and Kate changed everything about my opinion and knowledge of vintage rum. I mean, thank you, Mark and Kate. A 2-hour phone call, I could have pretty much published the transcript as the chapter. He gave me so much knowledge.
Right.
Incredible stuff. And, you know, Joaquin Simo gave me incredible information about chartreuse, which plays a key part in the book too. So I did get it written. I'm pretty proud of it, but that was the process, not the best process, but that's how it went. And I did file on time, which not a lot of writers can say.
There you go. That is, oh my God. I don't know. You could probably see the fear in my eyes, and you're like, yeah, I realized I had 90 days to write a book. Good Lord.
You know, the frantic pace kind of propelled it. Yes.
Nothing inspires like a deadline, baby. That's the.
Exactly.
Yeah,
exactly.
I would ask this, you know, you did all this, you spoke to all these people who, you know, gave you some great insights and knowledge. Did you ask them or are you curious about how does, especially the collectors, the ones who are really going for it, how do they enjoy the product? You know, do they like to sip on them? Do they make cocktails? Like what is the end goal? You know, you might know, or maybe even you got to taste some, I don't remember, cause you know, we were drinking, but, you know, I purchased a case of Old Overholt rye whiskey from Sotheby's that was from 1909, right? And we just drank it.
Yeah. I remember that.
We certainly weren't making cocktails.
I think that story is alluded to in the book. And I don't think I realized that case was the case that eventually got to you till after the book and someone told me. Mm. Most people prefer to drink it neat. Now some things you acquire. So what happened early on is these guys were acquiring bourbon, and if they were buying big lots, people would toss in, you know, stuff with it. You know, a lot of these bourbon guys only drink bourbon. And now all of a sudden they had all sorts of weird things. Not a lot of people drink neat gin. My man Tim McCurdy probably does.
That's actually what I was kind of alluding to, like the gin and maybe like the Amari or something. Yes, as you mentioned that, I bought another bottle of Overholt from like 1932, and it came with this bottle of the Hiram Walker 5 o'clock gin.
Yeah. Well, I think actually Jamie Boudreau at Canon was the first to really say, like, okay, I know I can sell incredible neat pours of bourbon. Now I have all these modifiers, all these liqueurs. No one's gonna fucking buy any of this stuff. Maybe I can start turning it into interesting cocktails from the past. So that's what people started doing with their gins, and their liqueurs is putting them together into vintage cocktails. Canon still has vintage cocktails on the menu. The Milk Room in Chicago became probably the biggest player in vintage cocktails when Paul McGee was running it. You still see an occasional vintage cocktail night at Dante. It's an expensive thing to put together. It's not going to have the biggest audience. You know, a vintage martini might have to go for $150 in full size. So how many are you going to sell? But, Jamie Boudreau told me, in the early days, I think we're talking, 2012 or so, he had a vintage cocktail menu on his massive 178-page iPad menu at Canon, but he might sell only one vintage cocktail a month. And now I think he sells maybe one a day. So people are buying them.
Yeah, he's told me similar, because I asked him in the beginning, why do you have it? Because it was right on the front of the menu, actually. It was like I don't remember what they were, but let's call it, an old fashioned $12, a Manhattan $10, and then the middle was this, Boulevardier from 1930, whatever, $1,200. I was like, why do you have that right on the menu if you're not selling very many of them? He goes, do you know how cheap a $12 cocktail sounds when you're looking at one that's $1,200 on the same page? Like, right.
It's also, let's admit, a good way to potentially get press. This bar has a $1,000 cocktail. Okay, no one's going to drink it, but Salvatore Calabrese kind of has been the great self-promoter and showman of selling vintage by selling extremely expensive, extremely old stuff from the past. Perhaps some of it delicious, but most people will never drink it. They'll just read about it.
The Mai Tai, right? The Mai Tai at the Merchant Hotel in Belfast, right? It's like $1,500, and they had all the right ingredients from 1944. And now they can't make it anymore because people did buy it, So, I think they had one bottle of, what was it, El Dorado 17 rum or something, whatever. I can't remember which one it was. But they sold it all.
Yeah, it's a cool thing. Yeah. People that excites, it excites, maybe you've had a few drinks and then you think, God damn it, I'm going to buy the $1,000 cocktail. You might regret it in the morning, but, you can put it on your Instagram and tell the world.
I mean, my last trip to France, I wandered into a liquor store, and this isn't even necessarily a Dusty. It's just a thing that was on the shelf there to allude to the fact that what you're saying is, like, sometimes you just want the thing. There was a bottle of Armagnac that was bottled in the year of my birth. And I was like, well, I'm here. I'm buying it.
Yeah.
Guys
like us that love spirits and love the history and have that collector's mentality, sometimes you just got to do it.
Well, you keep saying the word collector, and that's where it starts to bug me,
I don't mean someone who doesn't drink when I say collector. And yes, there has been some separation.
And again, you're right. They're mostly guys. I love him to death. Eric Witz. I don't know if you know him. He's aphonic on.
Yes. Instagram. Yes. He's in the book.
He is a font of knowledge because he has so many bottles that he loves and adores and holds on to, but he doesn't fucking drink them, and it just drives me crazy.
Well,
I always say my back bar is an amusement park, not a museum.
We're
going to ride these rides, man.
To me, and to a lot of people, in this game, the lack of knowledge of what something tastes like is far more valuable than what you could sell it for. So I have bottles that aren't open, and you'd have to offer them. I don't even know. I need to know what they taste like, and I eventually will. And I think a lot of people feel that way as well. I mean, Martin Cate has one of the only bottles of Ray and Nephew 17 left on planet Earth. It's sealed, and he's never tasted it, but I'm sure before he dies, he will.
Yeah,
I think if he was on his deathbed and he hadn't tasted it, he'd regret it.
I just worry. I would worry so much that something would happen to it or to me to stop that from happening. If I acquired it, I want to crack into it and get into it.
Here's my thing, Souther. I always buy two of everything, I'm an identical twin. I'm a Gemini. I'm from Oklahoma, so a two step. I got two of everything. Yeah. But the reason why is because, if you can find a couple of bottles or more than one bottle, especially something vintage like this, it's like the sneakerhead. It's like one to rock, one to stock, right? Yeah, so you can actually open one and then have the other one to maybe flip it or whatever. I mean, going back to Red Hook Rye, it's like I always bought, yeah. I worked at the shop, so I got the bottles for $50, you know, as an employee. And, you know, so that's pretty good. So, yeah, I bought two. I didn't make any money there, but I had access to all the Van Winkle and Red Hook Rye and her 16 that I could ever get. And I still have a lot of it in storage. But, you know, I know what that stuff tastes like because I got two bottles, you know, or more. Yeah. And I think that's it. And also, it just here's another thing, too. Like you went in on that case of old Overholt with a partner, right?
Yeah,
I think. Yeah. So to me, this is one of those things where, you know, when we used to do a lot of these like kind of apartment kind of movable feast, if you will, of like big people would bring, you know, bottles of rare spirits or something new and just exciting or whatever. It's like, just get together and just try it. You know, to me, it's all about more, it's more about the experience than the actual like item.
Oh, for sure.
So it's one of those things where, you know, like get together with some friends and, you know, it'll hit the pocketbook a little lighter and you'll have that experience of knowing what it tastes like, but also you had the experience with friends too.
Yeah.
So
absolutely.
That's my advice for what's
worth. Yeah, that's what it's always been for me too. Yeah. These, you know, like you said, Kulsar just graced you with all that booze, yes. Right? It's because we want to share it, you know?
I don't want people knocking on his door asking for more. So I'm loath to say it, but he was like, you know, let's do a one of a kind tasting here. Yeah. So
shouldn't have published his address in the book then. Jeez. personal cell phone, all that stuff.
I doxed him accidentally. Yeah.
No, I guess I sort of want to wrap up. I'm getting like all the deep philosophical questions in today. It's just, this stuff fascinates me so much. And I think that sort of what we're sort of saying here is that like this offers you a chance to kind of like taste something that's never gonna exist again. You know, I say this all the time about like, it's great to be nostalgic about stuff, but like every time I go back to the town where I grew up, something's different. And maybe the different thing sucks. You know, maybe like this beloved coffee shop is a Starbucks now, you know, that sucks, but you can't afford to be precious about every single thing in the past. And so, you know, these things, things are impermanent. And I completely agree with the philosophy of, based on that, we are some of those things that are impermanent. So, you know, try it out. Why not? Right. See what's out there, see what used to be, and get a better understanding of like why things taste the way they do now, you know?
Yeah. Every bottle is knowledge in a glass. I think Louis Pasteur said that.
Did he really?
Yeah, something like that. it might be one of those apocryphal things that, you know, like the, you know, Ben Franklin quote about how God made beer to make you happy. I don't think he said that either. No, but you're right. You know, anything on the market now, Pappy, George T. Stagg is also going to come out next year. But some of this great stuff from the past, every time a bottle's drank, there's one less on planet Earth. And that's another reason I find vintage so interesting.
Right. Yeah. I think it's not only just you're getting history every time you taste one of these things. You're traveling. You're going to that place. You're being among those people. You know, sure. You can imagine what was going on what was going on in 1909 when that case of whiskey got tucked somewhere that it got forgotten about. You know,
There's a very romantic, thrilling notion about it. And this auctioneer in my book says, you know, for some people, tasting a pre-phylloxera cognac, they might say this tastes worse than cognac today. But for the people that really care, the thrill of opening something that's been sealed for 150 years, the thrill of thinking how many hands it passed through, who made it, someone made it, who was probably born in 1820, how it got all the way to you in your glass, that's just, you know, flavor can't even match that. It's just such a powerful feeling.
Yeah, it's so experiential. You know, I've definitely opened some stuff in my pretty limited. I think this episode makes it sound like I've had a lot. I haven't. I really haven't had a lot of vintage stuff. But in my pretty limited experience, I have opened at least two bottles that were not right. You know, they'd gone off in some way, or they were just not good in the first place. But it doesn't matter. The thrill is to be getting to do it and to do it among friends and have a good time, you know.
Yeah, opening an old bottle's almost as thrilling as pouring it and tasting it, for sure.
Yeah, well, I can't wait to get a hold of a copy of
Dusty Booze, In Search of Vintage Spirits. You know, again, I wish I could have made it to your event the other night. I was going to pick one up then, but I'm definitely going to grab one and tuck into it, and I'm excited to do that. So thanks for putting out your 12th book.
We don't need to do
more out and about here.
At least 7 of those books didn't merit a podcast episode, maybe more. So
you're quite humble. Well, how can our listener sort of follow along with your shenanigans? You got some social media you want to plug? Your Instagram?
Yeah, I follow TikTok to learn the what the young the people are talking about. Yeah, the dance moves. No, I'm on Instagram, and I'm in Aaron Goldfarb on Instagram. I'm in full book promotion mode, so you'll probably follow me, see how much I'm storing my book at press, and then be like, fuck this guy, I got to quit following him. That's where I am. I'm a little quieter when I'm not in full book press mode, and the book is available wherever better books are sold.
Anyway. Yeah, we'll try and get some over at Amore Margo.
That'd be great. I'll come in and sign them.
Yeah. And then sprinkle a little dust on top too for sort of a nice little marketing.
I like that.
Yeah,
I like
there
that.
You go.
It comes with a little packet of its own dust. Vintage dust. And then one last question, because we have to wrap it up here. What are you mentioned off air, so I want you to mention it on air so people can hear. You're going to be doing some events with the book coming up outside of New York City, right?
Yeah. The only one locked in is going to be April 15th, tax day. Come spend your refund if you have one at the Great Vintage Amaro Bar, Billy Sunday. They're going to be putting together, I think it's going to be an a la carte menu of some of their best vintage stuff. And I think the crew from the Milk Room and the Office are also perhaps going to be making cocktails there. I'm not 100% positive on that. This is the first place I've announced it, so you got a exclusive.
Finally, a scoop on the old speakeasy. Yeah. That's Billy Sunday in Chicago. You got to mention that part.
Billy, yeah, they have a Charlotte location as well. Billy Sunday in Chicago, April 15th, 7 p.m. Central Standard Time. Details to follow.
Yeah, right on. Well, man, cool. Listen, this has been a great conversation. I feel like we could keep on going.
Yeah.
And that just means we'll have to have you back on after we've all gotten a chance to read the book. But really excited to read it. Thanks so much for spending time with us here today on the Speakeasy. Aaron Goldfarb, how many times have you been on now? Is this your third time on?
I think I did. I did one with Hacking Whiskey, and I did one with the legendary Janae.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah, that's right. Yeah, you were our 400th episode when you brought her on. God, yeah, that was a fun one. She's so cool, man.
She's awesome. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, two more episodes and get the blue velvet coat.
Oh, the 5 timers. Yeah. Yes, I'm in.
Yeah, well, somebody take us out.
All right. Well, that is it for this episode of the Speakeasy and our first episode of Bottled and Bond, the Speakeasy's special regulars only edition. So, like I said, check it out in the show notes to learn more. And while you're at it, whatever tier you're listening at, go to Heritage Radio Network to listen to more great shows just like this one. Click on the beating heart that might or might not still be on the homepage, but our hearts still beat for Heritage Radio Network. And this is also a fun reminder that they're in the middle of a annual fundraising drive. So check that out as well. Right. They do a lot of great work, but a lot of great shows and this one on the air. So check them out and support some of the good work that they do. But for now, that is it for this episode of the Speakeasy. So till next time, cheers, everybody.
Cheers.
Cheers, everybody.
Cheers.
So you don't shun the devil with your rock.
The Speakeasy is powered by Simplecast. Thanks for listening to Heritage Radio Network, food and drink radio supported by you. Keep in touch at heritageradionetwork.org/subscribe.
Hey, it's Francis Lamb, host of The Splendid Table. Every week on our show, we talk about food and cooking and the meanings of food and cooking. We talk with the most interesting people in food about their techniques, their culture, and everything in between. Whether it's about how fried chicken took over the world or how Instagram changes the way people are actually eating. It's a food show where everyone is welcome. Come join us. You can listen to The Splendid Table wherever you get your podcasts.